I am swamped at this time of year with clients facing urgent early January deadlines, so I decided to start 2020 with one of our most popular shows from 2019. My interview with Accepted's own Sydney Foote, who started advising Accepted's med school clients to acceptance way back in 2001.
Welcome to Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. Your host is Accepted's founder and world-renowned admissions guru, Linda Abraham. At Accepted, our mission is to get you to that unforgettable moment when you read your acceptance email and shout, "Yes, I'm in!" confident you'll be attending the perfect program to help you launch the career of your dreams.
For you medical school applicants aiming for a summer 2020 application and hopefully a June of 2020 application, pull up a chair. Sid walks you through the process in response to the following questions, among others. How should you choose where to apply? How many schools should you apply to? What's the difference between the personal statement, the most meaningful experiences, and the activity descriptions? How should you approach secondary applications? What about non-traditional applicants? Any tips that are different for you? What are her top interview tips? And should you, as an applicant, take a gap year? And Sydney even has advice for third-year med students planning to apply this summer to residency programs. Now, I again want to take this opportunity to thank you for listening to the podcast and wish you much success in this brand new, exciting year and decade. And now, the interview with Accepted Senior Medical School Admissions Consultant, Sydney Foote. It gives me great pleasure to welcome back to Admission Straight Talk, Sydney Foote, longtime colleague and exceptionally talented medical school admissions consultant. Welcome,
Sid.
Thank you, Linda. I'm delighted to speak with you today. Now, when this show airs, it's going to be June 4th. And the first day to submit the MCAS this year is May 31st. If applicants haven't submitted already when this show airs by June 4th, are they late? Have they missed the boat? And is their application already doomed to the reject pile?
That's a really good question. Every year, people panic about this first submission date. To be honest, it's one of the biggest myths out there that you have to get it in on the first day. Even the people last year who were verified, who had submitted their applications up through June 7th, were sent on the exact same day as the people who had gotten everything in on the first day of June. So you do have a little leeway there to be in the very first set. Now, are you late if you apply a week or two later? I don't think you're considered late at that point. It's when you go into July, end of July, August, that it's getting to the point where, you know, that's not probably the ideal time to apply. But I think it's really important to apply when you're ready. So if you are a week away from getting what you need to be able to finish your application, say you've got exams or whatever, and you don't have the time to put into it, it is far better to submit a week or two into June than it is to start waiting and try to get it, or sorry, to start rushing and getting everything in as soon as you can. That idea of a deadline is very much a myth. And so, you know, get it in when it's the very strongest.
Sounds good. How do you advise applicants to select the schools that they're going to apply to?
I like to look at the statistics first. I look at the lowest accepted value of the MCAT and the GPA and the cumulative GPA and figure out if a school has accepted someone in the range that my client is looking for. Once you've got that, then I look at acceptance rates. Are they applying to somewhere that only accepts, you know, a very small percentage of out-of-state students, for instance, or do they have a, you know, a overall very low acceptance rate? Those are good schools, even if you're in the range to apply to, but they might not be your in-range schools. They might not be your top picks. So I like to have my clients apply to a mix of places where they are competitive, based on the lowest score, at least, and hopefully more closer to the mean of their quantitative factors. But then I also want them to pick some schools that are in range and a few reach schools, but not too many. I think a lot of people really have overweight their reach schools, and they'll apply to a lot of schools that they might be in the lowest range for, but they aren't near the mean and they aren't that competitive at those schools. So I'd like to see a good balance. Once the quantitative factors are all in, you'll have a good list of what schools might be good choices for you. And at that point, it's really digging into the schools themselves, looking at the mission statements, seeing what their focus is. If they have specialties that you are interested in, for instance, if they focus on rural or urban medicine, or if they have a big global medicine department. So it's those kind of things that can really make that connection to what the student actually wants or what the client actually wants. And that way they can see which schools are the best mix for them.
Right. And obviously there's the in-state versus out-of-state factor also.
Yeah, that's a big one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, actually, I just want to mention that Accepted has two excellent tools. We have the Med School Selectivity Index, which it's a quick and dirty. It's not as comprehensive as MSAR, but it does allow you to see the average GPA, the average MCAT, and the acceptance rate for almost all U.S. Allopathic and many osteopathic schools. And we'll link that in the show notes. But and then we also have a tool that shows the acceptance rates in-state versus out-of-state for, again, almost, I think, all U.S. allopathic and many osteopathic schools. And that's at accepted.com/medical/in-state. Well, I'll link to it. Forget it. I'll link to it from the show notes. And that'll be at accepted.com/314. But those are two really good tools for, again, not as extensive as MSAR. I don't think they don't replace MSAR, but they are a good place to start or for a quick check.
Yeah, and I think it's important not to just look at the mean of the school, of the right. GPA and the MCAT, to look at what schools have traditionally in the past accepted, because that gives you a much broader range. And if you can, you know, make a strong case for yourself and you're close or above, you know, their lower score, but not near the median, then you still, I think you could be competitive at the school.
Right. No, I completely agree. And that's why I'm also saying check MSAR. But I think that the Med School Selectivity Index and the in-school versus out-of-school, out-of-state, rather the in-state versus out-of-state tool that we have are, you know, with their limitations, good resources for applicants. How many schools do you advise applicants to apply to?
It really varies. Some people will have just applied to a handful of schools for whatever reason. The better your stats are and the more connections you have to the school, the fewer schools you probably have to apply to. I mean, I've worked with clients who've only applied to like three or four schools.
And that's pretty risky.
It is very risky, but you know, it was places where they had done research or whatever. And so they were able to make those connections and get into those programs. I think most people who have more average stats apply to 20 to 25 schools. Yeah. Some will go into 30. And then some people will apply to a lot of allopathic schools and a lot of osteopathic schools. If you increase the number of schools, you're increasing your chances. So, you know, apply to as many as you think you need to. But you also want to keep in mind that you're going to be filling out secondaries for a lot of those schools. So don't overburden yourself and say, I'm going to apply to 50 schools this season.
And they tend to come all at the same time.
They do. And that's something I should mention, too, is that you can actually stagger your secondary so that they don't come all at one time. If you when you send your application in, you only need to select one school for it to be verified. So some people I've had clients before that will pick like 10 schools that they want to have in their first batch. And then they'll add another 10 once they get those secondaries and get things moving. And they just kind of keep that up through the summer, applying at, you know, the most competitive schools first until over a month or two. And it ends up with them having a much more kind of balanced season. I wouldn't recommend doing that at, you know, Harvard or Stanford or any of the, you know, the really competitive schools, because you want those to come in at the very beginning. But your state school, you might apply to a little bit later, or other, you know, osteopathic programs you can apply to a little later.
Sure, their cycle in general is a little later. I've heard that strategy kind of being used a lot or more frequently for applicants who, let's say, take the MCAT in May and then are expecting they don't have their scores yet, basically. Yeah. So yes. They get their application verified, they perhaps apply to their in-state schools, the schools they're going to apply to regardless of their MCAT score. And then when they get the MCAT score, they know whether they have to kind of aim down or can aim up in terms of additional programs.
Yep, that's a great strategy. Yes. You don't want to just apply to a lot of schools hoping that you'll get a certain score on the MCAT, because if you don't get it, you're still applying to those schools. Once you've selected them, right, you're an applicant. And that means you're a reapplicant if your score's not good.
Right. True. Even if you don't submit a secondary, you're considered right, a reapplicant. Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk a bit about the primary application, which is, of course, what most people are obsessing about as they're listening to this podcast, unless they already submitted it. And we'll get to secondary, so you're not wasting your time. Don't worry. Specifically, the MCAS primary application. What should go into the personal statement versus the most meaningful experiences versus the activity descriptions?
So I like to think of the personal statement as more of that first introduction. It's how they get to know you as a person. So you're really talking about broader strokes of who that person is. It can be around a theme, their commitment to service or your resilience in the face of struggle or whatever it is. But it's more of those broad ideas of this person and whether or not they are mature and really committed to medicine. So it's a much broader statement. The meaningful activities go into the specific activities that were significant to you, meaning they had an impact on you or you had an impact on others. I like to make that distinction because it's not just this was an important thing to do. It needs to be meaningful to you and have helped you in some way towards your growth and your kind of personal development. So pick those meaningful experiences that you might have mentioned them in your personal statement, but this is a chance to go into a little more depth and to really flesh out why it was so significant to you. And the descriptions, they're just usually much more basic descriptions. You don't have a lot of room. You only have the 700 characters to work with. But they should also include why it's important to you in a much more concise, compact way. You don't want anything up there just because you did it. You want to make that connection to why it was good for you to develop certain skills or good to help you decide that you wanted to be a doctor or good for you in whatever way it is.
Still, I think a lot of applicants struggle with, like, what if the most meaningful experience is something that they discuss in the personal statement, or should they not discuss it in the personal statement? I think that's something that they frequently struggle with. Can you give a few more guidelines on that one? Or
sure. You don't want to repeat anything. The same wording should not appear in your personal statement and your meaningful experience, but it's fine to have your meaningful experience be something that you talked about in your personal statement. The key is really to dig a little bit deeper in the meaningful experience to show, I mean, you want to show why it was meaningful in both places, obviously. But in your personal statement, it's going to be showing how you are developing as a doctor, for instance. Whereas in your meaningful experience, you might want to talk more about how you were developing as a contributor to your community, or you know, you could take a different angle on it. I think if an experience is really meaningful enough to be included in both your personal statement and your meaningful experience, it should have enough aspects to it. It should be layered enough that you can pick different things to write about. You could also take it in the meaningful experience talking about your effect on specific people that might not fit into your personal statement. So there's different approaches you take to both.
But under no circumstances should it be basically the same thing.
No. Right. And not right. In their secondaries or anything. It should be all very separate.
Okay. What do you think about gap years?
What do you mean? What do I think about them? They're great to take when you need them. I mean, some people are not in a position to apply when they
right.
are ready to.
I think that, you know, with the changes in the MCAT requirements, there are, there's more. It's harder to get the requirements in before you take the MCAT in order to get it done ahead of time. You know, I think that's difficult, increasing difficulty. And I think also schools are about 50% of accepted students, I think, do have at least one gap year.
Yeah. I mean, it depends what you're doing with your gap year, I think. Having something directed that's going to increase your profile is great. You know, and being able to make the problem, I think, with gap years is that sometimes people will lose contact with people who they need to support them in medical school. So you could fall off touch with professors over gap years. But that's something that, you know, it takes an effort to keep up with those people, but it's worth doing. You know, just keep them informed, let them know what you're doing and say, I'm applying next year and I'd really like your support. But if you're using a gap year to, you know, do work, volunteer abroad or do research or, you know, work as a scribe, there's a lot of really good ways to fill a gap year that can make you a more competitive.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of, I think the main point I'm trying to make in asking this question is you shouldn't feel compelled to take a gap year and you shouldn't fear the gap year. I think a lot of times applicants feel, oh, I'm losing a year. You shouldn't, it's lose it or use it, you know, use the year.
Yeah. Well, the average age for medical school applicants now is going up. Yeah. I think it was 24, 25 for matriculants last year. So people are taking gap years for sure. And that's not something, you know, people can get a lot of value out of them.
Right. And that additional maturity life experience can be something that medical schools value.
Yeah.
Now, if applicants use their best material for the primary applications, how can they have impressive material for the secondaries?
Well, that's something that I think you need to keep working on. For one thing, is once you get your primary in, your preparation does not stop. You need to keep volunteering. You need to keep shadowing. I think one of the most impressive clients that I worked with had, as throughout the whole year, she was looking for new shadowing experiences. And even after she finished her secondary, she was sending updates to schools about, the, you know, I went to see this doctor in this clinic, and really not just saying that she'd done it, but really getting into some nitty gritty about what she'd learned and how it kind of affected her perception of medicine. And she was applying, I think, for osteopathic programs, if I remember correctly. So she was getting this much more rounded idea of what osteopathic medicine was along the way. So I think that creating new material is really important along the way. I think that's one of the best ways to have impressive material. The other thing is taking time to reflect on what you've done and why it's meaningful to you is really important. And I think that's something that is kind of overlooked in a lot of this process. I think that it's so vital to have authentic experiences and to really show that this is something you care about. And I don't think people do that enough. They tell what they've done, but they're not really showing why it was important to them.
Right. They're not reflecting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. I sometimes like to tell applicants, if you want to say, oh, this was meaningful to me, well, why? And they'll give you an answer. And then, well, why? Well, why? Usually about the fourth or fifth why.
It takes a lot of whys. Yeah.
Yeah, you're getting to something that's distinctive and that's a little bit more profound than it was interesting.
Yeah.
I had a client, this was years and years ago, and it wasn't for medical school. He was applying to law school, and he'd worked at one of the national party conventions during an election year. I don't remember which party, and I really don't think it matters. And he wrote in his personal statement that it was a challenging and interesting experience. And I remember I called him up and I said, you know, I wasn't there and I could have told you it was interesting and challenging. Can you please tell me something I don't know about the experience? And he said, I absolutely hated it. And I said, well, why did you hate it? And he said, because of, you know, it was dirty. There was backstabbing. There was, you know, there was politics. And I just found I really didn't like it. And I said, well, you don't want to be negative or overly negative, but you can go into some, you know, greater depth than it was interesting and challenging, because again, that's a fairly meaningless kind of statement. But go, why was it interesting and challenging? Why did you hate it? You know, go a couple of layers deeper, and suddenly you're at something that's a little bit more profound. Or I want to help people, as you say so well in the interview webinar that you've done. Well, you know, that they all are there because they want to help people, or they're there for the wrong reason. Why do you want to help people in this way? You know, well, I want to do, you know, then it starts to get, then you're starting to get interesting and you're starting to get specific.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And it's pretty easy when you're reading personal statements to tell who really genuinely has that passion for medicine. And they're the ones that do go deeper and that reflect on what it means and what medicine means to them and what helping someone in this way means. And you can just get that from what they've written. And a lot of it is really, like you say, it's going past that really generic ideas.
The other thing that I think makes secondaries different from primaries is primaries are much more focused on why do you want to be a doctor? Are you qualified to be a physician? Secondaries are much more about the particular program you're applying to. So
some are, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, not all, to be sure, but many are, or have at least one question about that. And even the ones that are a little bit more generic, I think the applicant in their response should be focusing more on the particular interests and values of that program. Uh-huh. And I know, again, going back to your excellent interview webinar, which we will link to from accepted.com/314, you know, you point out, look at the school's mission and value statements.
Yeah.
And then tie your secondaries to that, where obviously your primary will have no connection to that whatsoever.
Yeah.
Now, how do you recommend applicants prepare for secondaries, which you've touched on in terms of staggering your primary, but let's say they didn't do that. Let's say they want to get them all in right up front so that they can have that early advantage.
That's great. I mean, starting pre-writing your secondaries is a wonderful idea. So by the time this comes out, you won't have a lot of time. You'll have about a month to prepare before secondaries start really rolling in. But one thing that I found really helpful is I love spreadsheets. And the best way I found to do this is to look at the schools where you want to apply and figure out which schools or which questions are related. So you'll have a lot of the specific school questions. You can't really, you know, you can't recycle those necessarily, but you can recycle your greatest challenge questions. You can recycle your questions about travel or your upcoming activities for the year or whatever it is. So there's certain things that you can use over and over again. After you have an idea of which ones you need to look at, I like to start with the longest. That it's much easier to cut material down than it is to go back in and add it in. So start with the longest question on the biggest challenge that you faced. Write it out, then start trimming it down for the other programs. You can knock out a lot of secondaries that way. The other thing that you really want to do is, yes, a lot of them are directly asking what school you want to, you know, why you want to go to this school. But even if they don't, that should be woven into all of your secondaries. So, you know, if they have a big emphasis on underserved communities or rural communities, or they have a big policy department that interests you, that kind of thing can be woven into all the different aspects of your secondaries. And that just really shows that connection that you have to the school and why you'd be a good fit. So it kind of does some of the heavy lifting for you.
Can it also be woven perhaps to the pedagogical approach that they take? For example, team-based learning or problem-based learning or system-based learning, whatever it might be.
Yep. That's all other aspects that are really important. Yeah.
Right. Do you have advice for non-traditional applicants who are perhaps 4, 5, 10 years or more out of college? I know you've worked with older applicants, non-traditional applicants.
I love working with older applicants. I think that they have a lot to bring to the table. And I think the biggest advice I would have is don't go into this justifying why you have always wanted to be a doctor, but then you took some other path. That is just, it doesn't ring true. If you really wanted to be a doctor, you would have done it like immediately. What you need to show is what has brought you to medicine at this point in your life.
Exactly.
Why now? Yeah. Why do you want to be a doctor now? The other thing is to own your experience. I think that a lot of people will kind of want to dismiss what they've done if it's not medically related. But the skills that you've acquired in whatever profession you're in, even if you're, you know, if you're working as a fast food clerk or whatever, you have certain skills that are applicable to medicine. And it's really important to own that. You probably remember the lawyer I worked with years ago, and she didn't want to talk about her law degree at all.
Right.
And I was like, no, this is really important in bringing out who, you know, the way you think, the way that you react to things. And these are all really applicable to medicine. And yeah, it turned out really well for her. The idea is just own your experience and don't downplay it at all, because you need to boost yourself up and you need to show that what you've learned and what you've gained is going to be valuable.
Right. And I think you should be able to show what transferable skills you've gotten in your career as a lawyer or an engineer or whatever, financial analyst or whatever it is. Maybe there's an analytical approach. Maybe there's a systems approach, whatever it is. There has to be something that you can bring. And again, not apologize for what you've done, just as you've said.
Yeah, you don't want to show them that, you know, you've been out of school for 5 years and you're exactly the same level of everything as everyone else. You've got those 5 years of experience that have been valuable, so use them.
Absolutely. Great. Okay, thank you. Now, I've mentioned already, and I'm going to turn to it now, that you've, for the last several years, presented an absolutely outstanding webinar on med school interviews. And we're going to link to it from the show notes at exip.com/314. I'm not going to ask you to repeat the entire presentation here. I don't think you want to do that. And I don't think our listeners have the time for it right now. They might in a couple of months. But if you had one piece of advice that you could share related to med school admissions interviews, what would it be?
The one piece of advice I have is to practice.
Okay.
Get comfy with your stories. That's the biggest thing that's, I think, can make the real difference. And I'm not just saying practice your answers, and I go into this in the webinar. You don't want to have a script that you're working from, but you want to be able to talk about your stories in a way that's familiar and that you know well enough that when you're nervous and your mind goes out the window, you still have some things you can talk about. And so I tell people to practice in the car or when they're washing dishes or whatever they're doing, just talk to themselves and talk about different things that they've done. And getting that level of comfort can really, you know, it really shows you off in the actual interview as someone who knows what they're talking about.
Great. Now, you have also worked with a wide variety of residency applicants over the years on their personal statements and their residency applications. While EROS is not yet open, how will a residency personal statement differ from a med school personal statement? Or how should it differ?
The biggest difference is you're not showing why you want to be a doctor because you're already a doctor. You want to show why that specialty is the right one for you. So that involves both, you know, showing your interest in the field and how you got there, but also the personal strengths that you have. Well, the technical skills that you have in that specialty, you know, are very valuable, but also the kind of qualities that you possess that are needed to be a surgeon versus a family care physician. Or, you know, you want to really show that that specialty fits you.
Any tips for residency applicants in general?
Take notes as you go through your rotations. Start writing things down, because when it comes time to write your experiences in your personal statement, you're going to draw a blank. But if you have that notebook of all the things that you've done and things that were important to you and things that you, you know, probably would have forgotten, it'll give you a lot of material to work with.
Great. Thank you. What would you have liked me to ask you?
I think one thing we didn't talk about was how to know when you're ready to apply.
And great question.
It's, are you ready this year? And I think far too many people just rush into it. Like, they're on this schedule. They were supposed to get out of school. They may have even had a gap year and now they're going to apply. It, you know, if you feel like your application's going to benefit from taking the MCAT again or taking a year to do more clinical work or to do more research, whatever it is, take it, because you're not, it makes you a stronger candidate. And if you apply before you're ready, and then you, like we said, if you don't get in, you are a reapplicant, and then you have to show how much stronger you are. So apply when you're ready, when you feel like you're the strongest candidate that you can be.
Great. Thank you so much. Sid, I think we're almost out of time. This has been absolutely delightful, and I want to thank you so much for joining me today. Now, I'm going to include links in the show notes at exip.com/314 to Sid's bio page. And if you, listener, are interested in working with her And I'm also going to include links to the med school interview webinars. But if you're interested in working with Sid, you can click through from the podcast at exhibit.com/314 to her bio page. And again, you'll be able to request her. Listener, I want to thank you too for joining us for this, our 314th episode. If you find the show worthwhile, please subscribe. Make sure you don't miss any future shows, be they with admissions directors, professors, current students, test prep pros, great admissions consultants, or alumni doing great things. You can find subscribe links in the show notes at exhibit.com/314. And a final reminder to register for Get Accepted to Med School with Low Stats, our upcoming June 6th webinar. You can register for free at exhibit.com/medlowstats or find a link in today's show notes at exhibit.com/314. This is Admission Straight Talk produced by Accepted, and I'm your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.